This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Yesterday, Jodie McKay, leader of the opposition in New South Wales, quit her job, leaving the Labor Party in limbo for the next couple of months until a new leader is elected. She never faced an election. The majority of her party apparently supported her, and there were no declared challenges. One of the reasons they say that she resigned was because she lost a by-election in a seat that another party had held for 90 years. So she never got the chance to face an election. The party room supported her. No challenges. She didn't win a seat that no one expected her to win. And yet, because of the brutal nature of politics, she's gone. In Western Australia, Tasmania and Queensland, three oppositions have been recently trounced by governments riding a wave of popular support about the border closures. And federally, Anthony Albanese, while seemingly secure in his position, is struggling to cut through, using a small target strategy with his policy announcements and downplaying the divisions in his party over climate change policy and other issues. So why do some opposition leaders make it into government and others fall short? And what's the measure of an effective opposition leader anyway? Is it just to wrongfoot the government, or should you actually be constructive? This morning for our talking point, we're looking at the role of oppositions in politics. And if you've got a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. Perhaps you'd like to text 0467-922-702, 0467-922-702. To do so, to talk about this, our guest is Ian McAllister. He is the Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the Australian National University, and we welcome him back to the program. Ian, very good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rod.
Now, I know that kind of your focus is on federal politics, but we might just have a quick look at Jodie McKay's departure. As I mentioned, she never got the chance to face an election. She didn't have any challenges within the party room. The seat that she didn't win, or that the party didn't win last weekend, has been held by the Nationals, the Country Party, for 90 years. What did she do wrong?
Well, I think probably the first thing to say is that being an opposition leader is really a very tough job, probably one of the toughest jobs in politics. And for example, when Winston Churchill lost the 1945 general election, he was approached by a voter who said that maybe he would be shot because he lost the election. He said, "There was something much worse waiting for me, leader of the opposition." So it really is a difficult job. Certainly people lose by-elections, but generally a by-election loss is not simply enough for a leader to be deposed like that. So there was probably more discussion within the opposition about the leadership, about the direction, about the ratings in the opinion polls and so on. And also it's very difficult to hold your party colleagues together when you're in opposition because you don't have access to government. You don't have the normal things that bring people together. You don't have the trappings of office, the government cars, the access to information and so on. So all of this creates great instability. And historically, what we find is that there's much more turnover in opposition leaders than there is in government leaders. And that's simply the reason. This is a very tough job.
Yes, they always say that oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them, and mostly because there's that kind of it's time factor. Mostly, not always, but that's often the case. You know, and if you're not in government, you don't have access to the policy making opportunities, which is in the public service. You have to kind of do all that on your own.
Well, that's right. And one of the main functions of an opposition is to provide an alternative. So what they have to do is put forward a suite of policies. They have to explain them during the course of being in opposition. Of course, it's very difficult to get airtime and so on and get your policies in front of government. They have to hold government to account. So they have to be a constructive opposition. They have to point out things that the government may not be doing correctly and so on. And of course, all of that can sound particularly bad in the present circumstances when we've got a pandemic and a crisis going. The opposition has to be very careful about how critical it is. So doing all of that requires great sensitivity, balance, getting your colleagues together, very clear communication, and also having a set of policies which are quite different from what the government is promoting. And one of the things we find in our election study surveys is that increasingly over the last 20 years, people find much less difference between the two major parties. So when people don't see much difference between the two major parties, they don't see much incentive to change.
Yeah. So one of the criticisms of Bill Shorten at the last election was that they had too many policies. And the criticism now of Anthony Albanese is, oh, they don't have enough policies. I mean, it's very hard to get the number right. It's when you release them as well, because if you do come up with something good 2 or 3 years out, well, the government just cherry picks it and you're left with nothing. You know, they didn't work through the policy they had on tax and on franking credits last time, or at least they didn't realise that there'd be such a backlash from people who didn't really understand it very well. You know, how do you get that right? How do you get that sweet spot between having too many policies and having not enough?
Well, very difficult. And the comparison with what happened with Bill Shorten was, of course, John Hewson, who lost the unlosable election to Paul Keating, and they put forward a whole suite of policies. And of course, it was very detailed, so there were mistakes in that, and people pointed that out. A lot of this really comes back to strategy. One of the problems I think we have in Australia is that we have too many elections. So, and I speak as somebody who studies elections, so I love them, so it's great for me. But yeah. For other people, it's probably not as good. Three-year parliaments internationally is really odd. There's only 2 or 3 countries in the whole world that have three-year parliaments, all the rest have 4 or 5 years. And what that does is it creates a very small window for oppositions to try and put forward policies. They really only have about maybe 18 months or so. And then you're almost getting into election mode again. People are looking forward to the election. So the sort of very tight electoral cycle we have here, again, exacerbates the problem that oppositions have. Mm-hmm. So if we compare that, for example, with the UK Parliament, where you have 5-year parliaments, that gives a much longer period for an opposition to try and hone their policies, road test them, develop a strategy, get that through to the public, communicate their message, and then go to an election.
So in the UK, there's generally a feeling that once you've lost an election, you go away and lick your wounds for a year or two. And that's a 5-year term, I think, if they go the full term in the UK. That's not the case in Australia. I mean, you come out of the blocks after an election loss, still going hard at the government. So what is the role of an opposition that has just been beaten, for example? The fact that, you know, a government may have won an overwhelming majority, which is unusual these days. It's a very narrow, although we've seen it in Western Australia. That's an incredible result in Western Australia. What's the role of an opposition when the government has a huge majority, the people have spoken, they don't want you? What do you have to do?
Well, I think what parties have to do is a process of renewal. They have to go through all their policies. They have to try and develop a strategy. And the good example of that was Tony Blair in the 1990s when he took over Labour. It was in a very bad state in opposition. And he developed new Labour. He developed a whole suite of policies which really swept aside a lot of the old policies they had that weren't electorally popular. And there was a process it went through. And then, of course, he won the 1997 general election. And then he was in office for a long time and he was a huge success. So an opposition that's really looking forward, thinking about what they can do, is an opposition that's really trying to develop their policies, trying to do a lot of testing with voters, finding out what they might want, and really developing those in a very sophisticated way. The problem they have, of course, is, as you mentioned before, they don't have access to the public service in the same way as they had. They don't have access to the same levels of information. And another problem they quite often have is a turnover of parliamentary members. So they may not have a lot of people within the party who's had experience of government, who knows a lot about the policy process, and they've got a lot of new members who they then have to train up and develop and so on. So these are major problems.
Okay, Peter has texted in, says, the path of the Western Australian opposition, I think there's only about two or three people in the opposition, will be interesting and may involve a de facto leader operating outside the parliament. Now, we have seen that in Queensland. Campbell Newman was basically the opposition leader before he entered parliament.
Yes, I think there's certainly models for that, but they tend not to go on very long. It's probably worth saying that we're tending to talk about opposition solely within a parliament. And certainly the opposition has a quasi-constitutional status within the Westminster system. But in other systems, opposition can actually take place outside Parliament. So in systems such as Switzerland, for example, where you have a lot of referendums, people have a direct say in opposition. They can make their views known to government. In the US states, things like recall elections are used quite frequently by which voters can engage with government and so on. So it's not necessarily the case that we have to think of opposition solely within a parliamentary context.
Okay. Although, say in Australia, the opposition for a Conservative government, Liberal National Party, is often the union movement. And, when Bob Hawke was leading it, or many other high-profile leaders of the union movement were de facto opposition leaders as well, whereas the, left-wing parties perhaps have to deal with an opposition from a particular media group.
Well, certainly there's that. But as I say, we tend to we're not particularly innovative in Australia. We have a Westminster system. We were innovative in the 19th and early 20th century. There was Lord Bryce, a famous political scientist, called Australia the democratic laboratory. But the sort of innovations that we've brought forward for the remainder of the 20th century really haven't been very substantial. And there are lots of models out there by which voters can engage more directly with government and express their views and so on. Whereas what we have is very much a Westminster system in the traditional model.
Let's talk to Owen. Owen, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Rod and Ian. Yes, actually, you've already really addressed my question. So I'd like to actually put another question to you. And that is, to what extent do you think that winning government and opposition is a case of being in the right place at the right time? Because I'm just thinking about two leaders, John Howard and Kevin Rudd. Now, if you look at John Howard when he came into power, and this is not to detract from any of their policy agendas or capabilities as leaders, but if you look at John Howard in 1995, he came in during a time when the Keating government was very unpopular, when there was a great momentum for change. And it's possible to argue in different circumstances the sort of turmoil the Liberal leadership had been through over the past few years before he came to power would have made it the party sort of untenable. If the government had been more popular. And similarly with Kevin Rudd in 2007, you know, he was campaigning with a government that looked tired and outdated after over a decade in power, and also on the back of the unpopular work choices.
All right, okay, Owen, we'll get on to that. Thank you very much for that, mate. I appreciate it. So, yeah, I mean, it's an in-time thing, isn't it, that... As we say, governments lose them. They have been in for 10 years or so. People think, well, it's time to throw them out and give someone else a go. Is that it? Can you think of any occasions when that wasn't the case?
Well, luck plays a major part in all of this, being in the right place at the right time. And the saying goes, never waste a crisis. So if a crisis comes along, it's quite often an opportunity, both for the government and the opposition. What you do find with political leaders is they tend to keep going. If they're good political leaders, they'll get a lot of knocks, but then they'll actually come back and they'll keep going. They won't take no for an answer. And John Howard, for example, in his various iterations with Peacock, he was more or less the same. He just kept going until he got the leadership, and then he made a good job of it, won a series of elections, and was very popular. So Owen's quite right. Luck is a major part in all of this. Okay. Being in the right place at the right time is really important.
And John Howard certainly was. But at the end, did his political instincts fail him and condemned the Liberals to be in opposition for a couple of terms, because he left. He was defeated. He should have left. He could have given Peter Costello a year or so to as Prime Minister to take over. Do you think that there was ever a chance that they were going to win that 2007 election, or was that just the mood was right, or could they have refreshed and kept Kevin Rudd in opposition?
Well, very difficult to know. John Howard was very popular right through his period in office. And one of the things you normally find with political leaders is they win an election and then their popularity declines gradually. And in some cases, it declines quite rapidly. For example, in the case of Paul Keating, in other cases, it declines very gradually, which was the case with John Howard. Whether he would won that election or the Liberals would have won it if they changed leaders, very difficult to say. As I think you've alluded to, the swing of the pendulum is very important in all of this. There's simply a mood within the electorate that the government has had enough time and there needs to be a change. But of course, the opposition plays a part in that. And Kevin Rudd had come along. He was quite charismatic. He was extremely popular with voters. He was the most popular leader since Bob Hawke in the 1980s. And there was a sense that there was a renewal going on. It was probably time for a change. One of the interesting things is that leaders are not very good at resigning, not very good at picking the time for when they should go. Over the last 20, 30 years, the only leader I can think who's actually retired in office was Robert Menzies. All the rest have gone one way or another.
60 years ago.
60 years ago, quite right. So all the rest have gone because they lost an election or they were deposed by their parliamentary colleagues.
Couple of state leaders. Neville Rann was in for 10 years and then stepped down. I suppose he knew when it was time to go. But then, of course, they lost the next election with Barry Unsworth as leader. It has happened occasionally at state level, but not very often. Let's talk to Max, and we welcome people to call and ask questions or make comments about the role of the opposition, or whether you can tell us what you think is an effective opposition or an opposition leader. 1-300-800-222. I've got some great text to read out as well. 0467-922-702. Max is next. G'day, Max.
G'day. What I wanted to raise with the professor is one of the things I think oppositions have to do is seize the moment when there's an opportunity to really expose something that's undesirable or extraordinarily off, if you like to use a vernacular term. They've got to grab, the opposition has to grab that and expose it and make a big issue of it. If not, it's a lost opportunity. And I'm thinking that fairly recently, I think the federal Labor missed an enormous opportunity. There was a bill that's passed now. It's called the Clarifying International Obligations for Removal Bill, and it concerns when people in immigration detention can be deported and when they can't. I want to try and keep it simple, Professor. What the opportunity lost was that on the one hand, the bill purported to portray Australia as a good international citizen, which will comply with and is committed to not sending people who are refugees, that is, they've been found to been persecuted and at risk, and so the word in the in the Refugees Convention is a French refoulement.
Okay, we might get to the question if we can, Max,
yeah,
please.
The question is, why didn't Labor seize the opportunity to expose the government? Because, just to finish, on the one hand, this bill said, yes, Australia is a good international, we will not send people back to danger. But they left in the bill a section which says, Section 197C, which was put in the Migration Act back under Abbott, it says it is irrelevant whether Australia has non-refoulement obligations. And and if an unlawful non-citizen has been assessed as being in danger if he or she is refouled, then that doesn't matter. They can still be refouled. That's Section 197.
Okay, all right. Okay, pretty complicated thing there. But Max, thanks very much. Ian, any comment on that? Generally, opposition and government have the same foreign policy. This goes kind of a little bit away from that. But what about what Max is talking about?
Well, there generally tends to be a bit of a consensus between the two major parties, as you say, on things like foreign policy to some degree and immigration and refugees, not so much in recent years, but certainly through the 1990s and early 2000s. Oppositions have to be constructive in what they do. I mean, what Max was talking about was something that might have been raised maybe in a parliamentary debate. What you find within the electorate is people are concerned about health, education, economic management. Those are the three issues which dominate. Issues to do with immigration and refugees very rarely impinge on elections. I mean, you have to really go back to about 2001 to the border protection election to find immigration and refugees as being an issue. So the sort of detailed point that Max was talking about, certainly something that could be raised in Parliament when a bill was being debated, but it wouldn't really resonate very much with the broader electorate.
I mean, there's a way of saying that really people are quite happy with the way things are and they don't necessarily want more migrants or refugees here.
Well, people have a hierarchy of things they're interested in, and top of that is health and education, to do with their lives, economic prosperity, issues to do with immigration and refugees. When we ask about it in surveys, typically maybe 4 or 5% would say it's a first or second ranked issue. So it's not really something that most people are particularly concerned about. Okay. So sure, the opposition could make an issue of that, but it wouldn't get them any traction with voters, I don't think, to any great extent.
Okay, Ian McAllister is our guest from the ANU. A couple of text messages here. Alex says, how can Federal Labor win when their front bench is nearly all failed lefties from previous lost elections, some since the period of Rudd? Renewal with moderates is surely their answer. So, you know, what do you make of what Alex says?
Well, he's making a reasonable point in the sense that but parties do need to promote a sense of renewal. They need to have a sense that there's new people in office, people are doing new things, and so on. And I mentioned the example of the Blair Labour government in the early 1990s, and there was a clear sense there that there was a new leader who was very charismatic, who was setting a new agenda. He overturned a lot of Labour policies and so on. He was a new person on the block, in a sense. For an opposition to be very effective, then they do need a sense of renewal. So bringing people in who've had the position in the past and sometimes generally doesn't work all that well. One of the interesting things is that in our surveys, we've asked questions about the changes in leaders that we've had since 2010. We've had four changes in prime minister. And in two of those four cases, people were actually quite supportive of it, which I was surprised. And of course, if we think about it, the sense is that you've just got somebody new in there. It's different. The parties are responding to what we want. So there's a sense of optimism and so on, rather than people taking the view that this was something very unstable and particularly bad for the political system.
Okay. Ryan says, I'm still fascinated by Tony Abbott's incredible ground, which he made up in 2010, only 3 years after Kevin Rudd steamrolled Howard out of his own seat. I was wondering what exactly happened to cause this shock result and how common are one-term federal governments in Australia? Not that Labor was one-term. Well, I mean, I know that. I mean, you've got to go back to the Depression to find a one-term government. Even, I suppose, even though Whitlam was in for 3 years, he was re-elected in 1974, faced the voters and was re-elected. And, you know, I don't know, this is a remarkable story, isn't it? Why was Tony Abbott so successful?
Well, I think he was a very energetic campaigner and he was very energetic in Parliament. There is a serious point here, which is the extent to which an opposition should be constructive. And the Westminster system is predicated on the idea that the opposition is the loyal opposition. So it's an opposition that would criticise policies, they would criticise pieces of legislation, things like that, and they would not criticise the government on matters of principle. And when you do get an opposition that's based very much on principle, then it can be very destabilising for the whole political system. So in the period when Tony Abbott was opposition leader, it did seem that the level of opposition was moving past being constructive and it was a bit more towards one on principle. And at that time, Abbott and many in the Liberal Party didn't really accept that the election had been won legitimately by Julia Gillard. They thought they should have been the government. So they didn't see the Labour as having a mandate to government. So they thought it was legitimate for them to be more energetic than any opposition had been in previous decades.
But hasn't it been the case since that time, really, since the 2010 election, that you know, it's been really a one or two seat margin for most governments? Most of them have not had a great majority in the parliament, and so they have had to work on that kind of knife edge that one dead member of parliament, one scandal away from minority government.
Well, there seems to be a lot of scandals, and it doesn't always change government all that frequently. I mean, we do find that it's a relatively small shift among voters that can actually change the outcome of an election. So what that leads the parties to do is micro-target electorates and micro-target groups of voters to try and get relatively small shifts, particularly in electorates that might be important. What we find again in our surveys is that in any one election, around about 10% of people might change their vote from the previous election. But of course, within that, there's almost an equal churn between the two major parties. So the number of people that's actually required to change the outcome of the election is really quite small.
Okay. Sally has a question. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning to both of you. It's not so much a question, it's just an observation from what I've been seeing. I think the Labor Party really should distance themselves and cut themselves off from the Greens, because the word Labor means work and the policies of the Greens pretty much are hampering that, the working side of things with Labor. You only have to look at the last election in particular in Queensland. As long as this keeps going on, the Liberal Party will be laughing all the way to the bank with election after election.
Okay,
it won't be much of a challenge or really anything for them to worry about.
Thank you, Sally. Now, that brings up an important point, though, isn't it, Ian McAllister's our guest, is that for, say, the Coalition, they've got kind of multiple opposition. They have the Labor Party, that's the main opposition party, but the Greens are an opposition party as well. There are independents that are quite often against the government as well. That's all part of it. They have to manage a whole lot of oppositions, don't they?
Well, they do in one sense, but of course the main opposition is the dominant party on the other side of Parliament, Labor. Now, there are some systems around the world, for example, in Germany, where a weighted majority is required in Parliament to pass legislation. In the German lower house, it's 75%. And that actually gives opposition parties and minor parties like the Greens a much bigger role than they normally would have. So the government has to deal not just with the major opposition party, but also with some of the minor parties as well. And it effectively gives them a veto power. The electoral system gives the Greens a great deal of importance to Labour because they get their votes through preferences. And our surveys show that round about 80% of Green votes end up with Labour. So they're really very important. They're sitting on the left wing of the Labour Party. The other important point about the Greens is that, and this comes back to protest parties and minor parties, typically the pattern with minor parties and protest parties has been is a very high turnover of voters. I mean, sometimes as much as 50 or 60% between two elections. One of the things we've observed with the Greens over the last four or five elections is that the turnover in the Green vote has become much less. In fact, it's become much more like one of the two major parties. They're retaining about 70, 75% of their votes in the previous election. And what that suggests to us is that they're really becoming an institutionalized political party. So what we've got is almost a three-party, or if you include the Nationals, a four-party system, but two dominant parties and two minor parties.
All right, let's talk to Greg. Good morning, Greg.
Hello, how are you?
Yes, what's your question, Greg?
I'm just wondering why there is opposition. Why is there an opposition?
And what do you mean by that, though? I mean, there are always going to be people elected to Parliament who disagree with the government.
There's, in the Commonwealth Constitution, there's no allowance for an opposition. There's no allowance for parties either.
No allowance for a Prime Minister either.
No, that's right. Yeah. So everyone's supposed to be an independent, and it's an offence to influence a Member of Parliament. And once you have a party, there is definitely influence.
Hmm. Okay, thanks, Greg. Good question. Ian?
Well, Greg's quite right that the opposition is not within the role of the opposition is not within the Constitution. It's one of the conventions, and it's a convention that we inherited from the House of Commons, the idea of a loyal opposition. What an opposition is really for is it plays a crucial role within liberal democracy, because it holds the government to account. One of the core principles of liberal democracy is accountability and responsibility. So if there was no opposition, there would be no mechanism for holding the government to account except for an election. It also provides voters with an alternative, as I mentioned, at an election, so voters actually know what the alternatives is. And another thing which tends to get buried a bit is that by asking questions, forcing the government to explain what they're doing, they're providing information to voters. So if you had a policy, for example, one party was saying, well, we should cut taxes, the other party was saying, well, we should raise them. By the two parties debating this and the reasons why they were taking a particular position on tax policy, it provides voters with information about what the best policy might be and gives them a better means of making a decision when an election comes along. So oppositions really, I mean, sometimes we don't like them because we think they're a bit destructive and so on, but they play a vital role within a liberal democracy.
All right. Let's talk to Sean. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Good morning. It's very hard for an opposition to get its message across when 70% of the media owns the government that's in power. I mean, you've only got to look at what's happening. And there's a bit more now with Peter Costello, with Nine Media, The Age, which was The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, which was a little bit not right on the government side, has now gone that way too. It's very hard to get your, I mean, you only had to watch the news yesterday morning with Greg Hunt. You know, I mean, it's, if we didn't have the ABC, and I'm proud to say I'm a friend of the ABC, it would be terrible.
Okay. So I think it's fair to say that much of the media in this country, the Murdoch media, favours the government. How much of a problem is that for the opposition?
Well, I think the media is always important, and one of the things that leaders and parties are always criticised for is the attention that they actually pay to the media rather than public policy, that they're always pandering to the 24-hour news cycle. Media is important. It's extremely difficult to tease out what the real effects of this, and I've spent 20, 30 years doing research on electoral politics. One of the things I've avoided is the media because it's simply too difficult to try and measure it. People pick up information from all sorts of sources, radio, newspapers, now digital media. They pick up information from people in their workplace, from their families, school settings, all sorts of things. So actually trying to say that, well, it's to do with, say, the ABC on one side or the Murdoch press on the other, certainly there's effects there, maybe 1, 2, 3%, whatever it happens to be. But it's probably not huge, actually. I think a lot of it cancels itself out. But as I say, it's not an area that I've done a lot of research on because I just find it too difficult and too complex.
Okay. Mike's got a good question. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, gents. Great topic. Why generally we see
Okay, we're losing Mike. I'm sorry, but Mike wanted to ask, I'm sorry about this, Mike, why does Australia and other Western countries typically have only two major parties? It's certainly the case in Australia, it's certainly the case in the US, certainly the case in the UK. Is it the case in most countries around the world, Western democracies?
In Westminster democracies, the typical pattern is two-party systems. The reason for that comes back to the nature of the electoral system. In majoritarian systems, such as we've got with preferential voting, I mean, we sort of think it's a proportional system, but it's not. It's still majoritarian. It's a degree of first past the post, similar to what you've got in the United States, Canada, Britain. That favours two major political parties because it exacerbates the number of seats that the party that wins a majority of votes actually gets. When you've got proportional representation systems, PRSTV, what we call Herr Clark, or party list systems, as you have in typically in Europe, that generally leads to multi-party systems. And that also generally leads to coalition governments as well, whereas coalition governments are very rare in Australia. So two-party systems generally associated with majoritarian voting, first past the post, multi-party systems, as you find in Europe and a lot of other countries, Latin America and so on, generally associated with PR, proportional representation.
Let's talk now to Jill. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hello there.
Yes, Jill, what would you like to say?
I'm really grateful to be living in a liberal democracy. And I love the fact that we have opposition, you know, putting up alternative views. Sometimes we wish for more. I'm just thinking, this is more a comment than anything, but try being Alexei Navalny in Russia. Yeah. Try being Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar. Try being Svetlana, I can't pronounce her last name, Skinskaya, something like that. Try being those people, you know, yeah. And get involved. You know, people say, oh, I'm not interested in politics. I think, oh, for goodness sake, you know, be grateful, get involved. That's my comment.
All right, Jill, thank you very much for that. Ian McAllister is our guest as we talk about the role of the opposition. You know, does changing the leader of the opposition make much difference?
It generally does, and what you find, not just the leader of the opposition, but Prime Minister as well, there's always a honeymoon period, which lasts about 100 days or so in the opinion polls, and then this slow incremental decline in popularity occurs. So it does matter in the short term, and really the only question is, once they start to decline, how rapid that decline in popularity is. It can be arrested by winning another election. So if you look, for example, at John Howard's popularity, he was extremely popular in 96, started to gradually decline, then he won 98, he rose again, and then his popularity declined, then he rose again in 01, and so on. So the normal pattern is voters actually like to see something new. They like to see a new leader. They like to see a new government, and it gives them a sense of optimism. And then the sense of, pessimism sets in again, and then there's a slow decline in trust and popularity.
Jeff says, it's a fine line between being a constructive opposition leader and a miserable whinger. Jeff says, I think Bill Shorten is the ultimate whinger. Bob Carr and Neville Rand both knew how to constructively oppose. I think it's important to point out Bob Carr was in opposition, or was opposition leader, for 7 years before he won, and that was after a couple of scandals in New South Wales Liberals. So you got to hang around, isn't that the case? Although, back in South Australia, when Thomas Playford was Premier, the opposition leader there, and I'm sorry I don't remember his name, he lost, what, 4 or 5 elections and died in office. They didn't change after he kept being beaten by Thomas Playford. That was a remarkable time in Australian politics. And, of course, we had long stretches in New South Wales. It was Labor was in for decades. In Victoria, it was the Liberals were in for decades. In Queensland, the Country Party was in for decades as well. What does an opposition do if they're out of power for 20 years?
Well, extremely difficult, and extremely difficult to motivate your members and your party activists. And if you're looking at the prospect of losing an election, then it creates great instability. You're risking factions developing within your party. It's going to be very difficult to put forward policies and things like that. And then you've got the risk of extreme groups coming in that might start taking over branches and things like that. That was something that happened to the British Labour Party in the 1980s before Tony Blair took over. I mean, what your caller said is a very interesting one, and there is a very fine line between being a constructive opposition and a sort of almost verging on being an opposition of principle and just opposing for the sake of it. Mm. And a lot of that comes back to how well you can communicate with voters, and you can pick up issues that voters have concerns about. So you're talking to voters a lot, you're finding out what their concerns are, and then you're trying to articulate that and trying to improve public policy to respond to it. So it is a very fine line. And of course, when you get situations where oppositions become one of principle, that they're really opposed to the political system, then that's when you do have really major problems. So, for example, in Scotland, the Scottish National Party, they're in government, but when they were in opposition, they were in opposition of principle in the sense that they wanted Scotland to become independent and do want that. So they were opposing the whole nature of the political system. The Irish Nationalist Party during the 1950s and 1960s, they were in opposition party of principle because they wanted to see Northern Ireland become part of the Irish Republic. They didn't want the political system as existed to be maintained. So there is a very fine line in all of this.
Scott writes, 0467 922 702, if you'd like to text in a comment or a question. I think the term opposition is part of the problem. I agree with Scott. Couldn't we think of a more constructive term? It seems to me that such a title must promote conflict rather than solutions. I think that's a very, very good point, isn't it?
Well, it is a good point. I'm not sure what you would call it, but I think it's taken into account by Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition, as it's called in Britain. Yeah. So by the Loyal Opposition, you're saying, well, they are the opposition, but they actually believe in the political system. They're constructive. They're focusing on policies. They're communicating with voters. They're loyal to the political system.
Let's talk now to David. Good morning, David. Wants to talk about Canada. G'day, David.
Oh, hello, Rod. What a great topic. Good talk. So much about this. I was very curious. Yeah, actually, yeah, you mentioned one of the previous comments. It was about how there are often only two major parties in our systems. But yes, Canada always seems to have had more than that. Even though I think it's a first past the post. But I was very curious when I was doing a bit more reading in a few years back. There was a party there that was the I think New Democrat Party, and the then leader of that party, Jack Layton, who I think passed away, led the party to become official opposition, displacing, I think it was the Liberals at the time, who are not like our Liberals. They're more sort of left of our Liberals, I think. But I just wonder how often does that happen, and and what does it take to actually bring that about?
All righty. Thanks very much for that, David.
Well, Canada is quite an interesting case. It's got a very strong sense of federalism. So they have a lot of regional parties. So, for example, the NDP that you mentioned, the National Democratic Party, that was by and large a regional party. It's had the Parti Québécois, PQ, is a strongly regional party in Quebec based in Montreal. So there's a very strong sense of federalism and federal independence, which we tend not to have. So our national parties are really national parties. They're not based in Queensland or they're not based in West Australia. Also, Canada's had a lot of electoral instability over the last 20 years or so, not so much in recent elections. And there's been a lot of turnover in the parties, which a lot of it comes back to landslide majorities and what I mentioned, the majoritarian system. Once you get a party that might get 55, 60, 65% of the vote, they can quite often get 70-80% of the seats in Ottawa. And that, of course, has a big effect then on the subsequent election and the things that we've mentioned about the effectiveness of an opposition if they've got a relatively small number of members and so on. So Canada's a sort of interesting case, but I think a lot of it really comes back to the very strong sense of federalism and regionalism that they have.
The US is different, of course, because there's no official opposition leader to the president. Does that mean that if you are of the opposite party and you are the leader in the Senate or the House, that that in fact makes you, you know, the de facto opposition leader?
Yes, it pretty much does, because you've got the separation of powers. And again, you've got a different system. And as you know, quite often you can have a different party which dominates the Congress and the Senate as opposed to the president. And that tends to foster, historically it's fostered more compromise and a willingness to engage with particular issues to try and get a resolution. Of course, not so much in recent years with Trump and so on, and also to some extent with Obama and things like health policy. But the American system is quite interesting in the sense that people look to Congress and the Senate for different things as opposed to the presidency. So for the presidency, they tend to look to international leadership, foreign and defense policy. And when they vote for Congress and the Senate, they tend to look for domestic policy. So they're interested in things like health, education, and so on. And to some extent, those things are overseen by the particular states as well. So it's a very different system to the normal, regular Westminster system.
Who do you think have been our best opposition leaders? And what even makes a good opposition leader?
Good question. Difficult to say. Good communication, I guess. A willingness to tackle hard policies, to call the government to account on particular issues which they think need to be highlighted, which maybe the government is trying to hide or is not dealing with properly. It's difficult to say who has been a top opposition leader. I mean, John Howard was very good when he was in opposition.
He was Mr. 18% at one point when he was
opposition. Well, he was, but he came back and he was very resilient. I suspect somebody like Bob Hawke would have been a very good opposition leader. But of course, he went straight to become prime minister almost
opposition
as soon as he was elected.
For 3 weeks or 4 weeks?
Yeah, something like that. But I can imagine he would have been very good because he was extremely popular and he had a good sense of what voters actually wanted. So difficult to say. I think communication, policy development, these are all skills that an opposition leader should have. Keeping your party together in very difficult times. And really a very difficult job, the worst job in politics, I think.
I suppose winning an election would make you a good opposition leader, would it?
Well, you wouldn't be the opposition leader then. So, yes, if you win the election, then that's it. Basically, opposition leaders either disappear off the map. You don't hear from them again, or they win. So there's nothing really in between. Now, you mentioned some of the people who've hung around for quite a long time in South Australia, Playford and so on. Those are really in different times when the personalization of politics wasn't so important. What we've seen in the last 20, 30 years is that people really identify with political leaders. They personalize politics in a way that they didn't in the past. And a lot of that comes back to the rise of television from the 1970s, 1980s onwards. It means that there's even more focus on opposition leaders than there has been in the past. And if they don't perform in the eyes of voters, then basically, I think their colleagues are going to get rid of them.
Although it's very difficult to get rid of a Labor leader these days, that is one of the great lasting legacies of Kevin Rudd. He made it very, very difficult. And it also means that if you do want to get rid of the leader, it might take months to replace them, which makes it even more chaotic at times. Ian McAllister, thank you so much for your time this morning. I hope you enjoy your weekend, but thanks so much for your insight and your wisdom today.
Thank you very much, Rod.
That is Ian McAllister, the Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the ANU, and thanks so much for all your calls.
Overnights with Rod Quinn.
On ABC Radio.